back of her or regress it, and paints a picture of the artist painting a picture of the landscape. But still something is missing. That something is still his real self painting the second picture. So he regresses further and paints a third. A picture of the artist painting a picture of the artist painting a picture of the landscape. And because something is still missing,
that voice in the in the song. Anyway, I start with that to illustrate the problem. So maybe you should. You're supposed to say something first.
I think that was a wonderful musical preface to the whole thing. Well, after that, this is Chris Wallace. He studied in the States at Rochester and Berkeley and came to Oxford to do his MPhil in classical Indian religions with our Reverend Sanskrit professors here. And Chris's special interest is Shaiva Hinduism, and he's going to talk to us today. I've seen him on and off throughout the week in Blackwell's, getting more and more excited, and his eyes growing brighter and brighter with his discoveries. So I'm very excited to hear him talk today about consciousness and Shaivism.
Right, so that piece of contemporary dance, ambient dance music contains this intriguing kind of narration of this idea of trying to fully encompass an observed scene, in that case a landscape, and the artist realizing that something is left out. He is left out of the landscape he has painted, and he is a part of that landscape, and thereby trying to continually step back further until the entirety is grasped. And the quote ends by saying that the only way for this to really happen is that the observer and observed, these two conceptual categories, collapse completely. As a parallel to this, there's a painting which I'd like to show you, but the book that it was in at Blackwell's cost £50. So it's by Dali, and it's Dali from the back painting Gala from the back. So he has a woman looking into a mirror, and he is painting her image in the mirror. But then instead of that painting, what you actually get is a painting of Dali painting the woman in the mirror. And so you see his back. So it's Dali from the back painting Gala from the back. And it's again this issue of trying to encompass the totality of a moment of experience artistically. So why is this relevant? Because it really points up the main kind of problem in studying consciousness, which is that we are trying to thereby understand ourselves. We're trying to understand a central feature of our experience, which we are inside all of the time, and it's basically impossible to get outside of it. Consciousness researcher Robert Chalmers, I think Robert's his first name, David Chalmers, anyway, he has a couple of interesting quotes. He says, "Physics is information from the outside. Consciousness is information from the inside." When we are conscious of something, we are processing data about the state of reality or a portion of the state of reality from the inside, as it were. What does that mean? Well, let's look at the issue from the perspective of modern physics. We've got a universe. Okay, the universe is one thing, hence the name universe. It is one field of matter energy. Okay, since Einstein, we know that matter is energy, energy is matter. Therefore, there aren't really even two things in the universe, there's only one. I mean, from a purely physics perspective, I'm not trying to advance a spiritual monism here. So, as one physicist observed, I believe it was Erwin Schrödinger, for a physicist to observe the universe, what's happening there? Well, a physicist is made of the very things that he or she is observing, that is to say, quanta, particles of matter and energy in various states. So when he observes, he or she observes the universe, it is nothing other than one bit of the universe, as it were, observing another bit of the universe, one bit of that field of matter energy observing another bit of that field. So thereby, for the universe to observe itself, as it were, through the medium of the physicist, it must divide itself into two, an observer and an observed, thus creating an illusion of a fundamental dualism in every single observation that takes place, when in fact we still have one singular field of matter, interacting matter energy. Okay. So another way of articulating this problem is with reference to Gödel's incompleteness theorem. Admittedly, there he's talking about formal logical systems, but there is a philosophical metaphorical analog to Gödel's theorem, which suggests that ultimately we cannot understand our own minds because our mind is our tool of understanding. Just as we cannot see our own faces with our own eyes, it is not inconceivable to expect that we cannot mirror our complete mental structures in the symbols which carry out mental operations. That is to say, all the theorems of mathematics or any other formal system suggest that once the ability to represent your own structure has reached a certain critical point, that is the kiss of death, it guarantees you can never represent yourself totally. I'm quoting there Hofstadter from his famous book, Gödel, Escher, Bach. So, you know, the idea being that you cannot fully understand anything by its within its own terms. You have to be able to get outside of it, which is not always possible. And certainly I think a lot of people in the world and in Western philosophy tend to think that it is not possible to get outside of the mind and observe it from the outside because there isn't really anything else but mind. And that's where I think Indian theories of consciousness come into this whole picture. And here I'm just outlining a kind of general thesis, and I'm going to recap these points. So in states of awareness, which people like Robert Forman have called pure consciousness events, which are referred to in the yogic literature as samadhi, and in Shaiva literature by a variety of terms, what allegedly takes place is a collapse of the observer and the observed. In this case, the observer is the mind, and the observed is the object of awareness. Okay? So the key distinction that has to be made here is that in these systems there is a difference between mind and self, as it were. I'm here thinking the classical systems of like Sankhya and Yoga, okay, not in Shaivism so much. What I mean to say here is that when in the samadhi state, samadhi literally means putting or placing together, two things coming together in the same place. Those two things in classical yoga are the mind and the object of awareness. That is to say, the mind is dissolved into the object of awareness, and as the literature says, the object alone shines forth, free of all mental attributions. So there is a pure awareness of the object. Now the whole point to this is that when the mind gets dissolved in the object through intense, repeated, prolonged concentration, then you become aware that there is something else present, which is referred to as pure consciousness in yoga literature, the purusha. That is to say, even when the operations of the mind have become totally and completely still, there's something else present. So there is a tripartite theory of knowledge in these systems, which carries over into Shaivism. The known, the process of knowing, and the knower. The process of knowing, the means of knowledge, that is to say, the mind in this case, right? Now, what Sankhya doesn't envision, but Shaivism does, is an ultimate collapse, a further collapse, a collapse of the knower as well, where all three of those categories cease to exist as separate categories, and one abides in the transcendent state referred to as the nameless, because it's utterly non-discursive, totally indescribable, because not only has the mind become still, but even the category of subjective knower has ceased to be present in any meaningful way. That is to say, that I, the sense of I, is gone. Now there.
Could you repeat what that state is called?
Well. I mean, I'm specifically thinking of the term anakya in Shaiva literature, the nameless state, the fourth. Well, it's just the state that which is considered to be the ground of the knower, the process of knowing, and the known. Okay, and a transcendent state beyond all three of those categories. Okay, so I know I just sort of rushed through a lot of material very rapidly to try and. Give an overview, which is probably more confusing than illuminating. So I'll sort of start again and we'll work through them some more. So David Chalmers asked the question, why is the performance of brain functions accompanied by experience? This is called, in cognitive science of today, the hard problem. The problem which there is not yet an answer to, and which is being fiercely debated. What is it about the brain, if indeed you think consciousness is a kind of byproduct of brain function, that causes the operation of these mental functions to be accompanied by a subjective sensation of experience, by which we mean the experience of redness, the experience of middle C, of the taste of an orange, and the subjective unification of those experiences within the awareness of the knowing subject. So that is to say, now quoting Rita Carter, she does assert, which not all scientists do, that there must be a difference between the contents of consciousness and consciousness per se. I mean, what are the contents of consciousness? The color red, the sound of middle C, the taste of an orange, the image of a cow. And those contents are things that we believe are out there in the world. And consciousness is this thing which, in fact, is reshaping itself in conformity with those perceived objects in rapid succession. So in the this idea is captured really beautifully in, I think, the second or third sutra of the Pratyambigna Hridayam, which is a Shaiva text called the Doctrine, the Heart of the Doctrine of Recognition, which says in its second or third sutra, the mind contracts. The mind, though it is limitless consciousness with infinite potential, contracts in accordance with the objects perceived. When you perceive an object, it's a mental sort of contraction, as it were. This is a metaphorical talking, but I think it really captures something. A mental contraction around that object and a conformity to that object. There's often the metaphor of the crystal, the clear crystal. You put it on a red thing and it seems to be red. That's the mind contracting in accordance with the object perceived. Okay, so why are these cognitions and perceptions accompanied by this subjective experience we call consciousness and have such a hard time talking about, because we're always inside it? Well, the non-dual Shaiva tantric tradition would answer, because consciousness is not only a fundamental property of the universe, but in fact the fundamental property of the universe. So I don't have a thing there. Here. So what I'm mainly thinking of here, of course, is probably the greatest and most articulate of all the Shaiva philosophers and masters, Abhinava Gupta, who lived in exactly 1,000 years ago, and authored a number of texts, one of which I'll be quoting from today, is the Tantra Sara, the essence of the Tantra texts and the Tantric philosophy and theology. Okay? So when I'm referring to Shaivism, it's of course impossible to say anything meaningful about such a vast category as one of the great Indian religions, but here what I'm really talking about is the non-dual Shaivism of Abhinavagupta, okay? So for that form of Shaivism, the kind of fundamental principle of the universe, the first principle, the a priori principle, is consciousness. He likes the word samvit, or chit. Chit shakti, the power of consciousness. Okay. And in fact, there is a sort of hierarchy of fundamental principles of reality, starting with chit shakti and proceeding with swatantriya shakti, the power of absolute freedom or autonomy, ananda shakti, the power of bliss, and so on. So these concepts are articulated in a theological context by saying that the deity Shiva, who here is not one member of a pantheon, but the deity with a capital D, the overarching transcendent divinity, the deity Shiva, his most inherent power, you might say, is his power of consciousness, his chit shakti. That is the fundamental characteristic of who he is. And not only who he is, because this is a non-dual system, who we are as well. So the very first sutra of the Shiva Sutras, 1.1, is Chaitanyam Atma. The self is consciousness. Okay? I'm using the abbreviation CSNESS for consciousness. That literally is the first sutra, just self equals consciousness. The self is consciousness. Consciousness is the self. Okay? So what does that mean? It means that in the quest for the self, which is obviously something that's obsessed Indian philosophers since time immemorial, what is the referent of the I cognition? This answer, I think, was arrived at and could only be arrived at through meditative disciplines, whereby the contents of consciousness, the rapid stream of endless cognitions that are embodied by neural firings in the brain, comes to an end eventually in meditation, and one experiences a state of pure awareness. So it's very important here to make a distinction between cognitive scientists frequently use the term consciousness exclusively to mean consciousness of something, as indeed do the Buddhists. Consciousness is only consciousness of. There is no principle of consciousness with a capital C. But for the Shaivas, there certainly is, for these non-dual Shaivas. That is to say, when the stream of cognitions has ceased, there is something. There is a pure awareness that yet remains, whereby you are aware with no mental activity. I don't know what an EEG scan would show, certainly less activity in the brain. In fact, what's this guy's name? Nyberg or something like that. He did these very interesting experiments where he got these experienced Buddhist meditators into a room and put an IV in their arm and let them go into meditation, and when they were feeling like the onset of the samadhi state, they would jerk a little string, and then he would inject the radioactive fluid that stains the blood so that you can see where the blood's going in the brain. So anyway, he observed a number of things, including the fact that there was far less blood flow to the areas of the brain that are concerned with the perception of time and space, for example. That is to say, a kind of physical correlate to the subjective experience the meditator has of going beyond time and space. I was in a place of timelessness. I have no idea how much time passed. This sort of thing. And losing the sense of the body and just kind of floating there. Anyway, so these studies are being done. But at any rate, what happens is the stream of consciousness by which the mind's constantly jumping around. Even now, I mean, I know from experience that you guys are listening to what I'm saying in part, but you're also thinking about what you had for lunch, and, you know, there's all kinds of other things happening. Anyway, so that comes to an end, and there can be a sort of awareness of the environment, although, you know, when you dim the lights and do all those things, you're obviously trying to reduce those sensory stimuli. But what I mean is not that there is no more perception, but that there's no more cognition about perception. There's no more mental activity. There's a total passive receptive awareness. So the scientist Arthur Dyckman, however you say his name, he classified these two states of consciousness, active and receptive. Active being the normal state of consciousness we are in order to drive cars and do all kinds of things, although if you get experienced enough at driving a car, you can slip right out of active mode and still do it. And receptive mode is that state where you are not analyzing, you are not doing mental work, you are just passively receiving. So it's what happens when we start off listening to music in active mode, and then for most of us there's a shift at some point to receptive mode, and most of us also find that that is the state in which the music has the power to move us in some kind of really profound way. Once we stop the analyzing and just receive. So, anyway, so this is the state of thing I'm trying to describe for those of you who don't have a meditation practice. The state, maybe perception is still going on, although with enough practice, even perception is gone. But for most people, there's still perception, just no cognition. But there's awareness, and what also remains is the sense of I, not as a cognition, but just as the sense of your existence. It's kind of hard to describe. Anyway, my point is that what you've got is there's you and there's your awareness, and the realization that these guys had, or the theorem that they propound anyway, is that those two things are one and the same. The self is the consciousness at back of and underlying all cognitions, and there is no other self than that. And that very sense of being I is the sense of consciousness. Okay, so let me return to cognitive science for just a moment.
What was the point of this distinction?
Oh, I was just trying to illustrate what happens in meditative states and why those states lead up to, I think, this kind of assertion of Chaitanya Mahatma, okay, that for Dyckman, he talked about how being in the receptive state was not a state of meditation, but was necessary to entry into meditation, that you get yourself into that passive receptive state, and then you can progress towards the state of meditation, because it necessarily involves leaving the analytical, active, mental grabbing and rearranging and parsing and synthesizing operations that the mind is engaged in, right? So that's why I was saying how you can think of it as stages from that kind of active analysis to passive perception but without cognition to eventually not even perception, but awareness still remains. Okay, you never reach a state, no matter how still the mind becomes, no matter how deprived you are sensorially, you never reach a state where awareness is ceased unless you fall into deep sleep. Okay. Okay, so for Abhinavagupta, consciousness is, again, the fundamental property of the universe. As I mentioned last week, I think, the distinction is that from the materialist point of view, consciousness is a product of all brain function taken together somehow. Nobody knows how that would work, but that's the assertion that's made. Consciousness is an epiphenomenon of the brain. Or as Darwin famously said, the brain excretes thoughts like, what was the analogy?
Bile.
Yeah, like someone else.
Like no, liver excretes bile. Yeah,
yeah, okay. Yeah. Right. Anyway.
Delicious.
Whereas for Abhinavagupta, consciousness is the fundamental principle. It was there before any material reality arose. and it will be there when all material reality is gone. Again, non-dual tradition, where our consciousness as individual finite beings is not different from the divine consciousness. Well, it's different in a way. It's not different in kind, but it's different in the fact that it is contracted. So each one of you is divine consciousness, is God consciousness, if you will, in a contracted state. Contracted how? Contracted with the belief that you are Jean-Marie, or Tom, a white male of French or Irish descent, etc., etc. Those that sense of identity is the contraction because, of course, God has the sense of being everyone and everything simultaneously. So it's a contraction to be identified with this form. But other than that difference, there is no difference between... You see what I'm saying? So it's not that... And furthermore, there aren't multiple entities here. There is only one consciousness. But it is so infinite that it can apparently fragment into all these different contracted forms. Okay? So, manifest reality arose out of consciousness. In Abhinavagupta's Tantra Sara, this text I've translated the first five chapters of, in the third chapter, he talks about how divine consciousness, Shiva, to overgeneralize it, what he does at the beginning of time, in a kind of metaphorical sense, is he simply becomes aware of all the potentialities that exist within him, all the shaktis, all the powers and potentialities that inhere within him, which in a kind of linguistic mysticism get identified with the 50 phonemes of the Sanskrit alphabet and so on and so forth. But the main ones... are power of consciousness, power of freedom, power of bliss, power of will, power of knowledge, power of action. Those are the primary powers that inhere within consciousness. Now note the difference between this doctrine and other doctrines of the absolute or Brahman in Indian thought, where Brahman is thought to be completely nirguna. You can't describe any qualities he has. Here that's not the case. Some people say, Brahman can't have any qualities because that would constitute a limitation. But here, Abhinavagupta is saying, no, the Absolute has these qualities, consciousness, freedom, bliss, etc., but they do not constitute a limitation because they are infinite. Okay? And in fact, from his perspective, to not attribute these qualities would be a limitation, to not attribute the quality of absolute freedom, for example. The consciousness has the freedom to manifest itself in any form at any time. So anyway, beginning of time, metaphorically speaking, God, as it were, surveying his own self, which is just pure potential energy. Nothing is manifested. It's just a field of pure potential. Becomes aware of all the forms of, all the powers and forms of consciousness existing, inhering within him potentially. And then makes the decision to make those manifest. Notice that the last of this sequence of seven powers I enumerated, consciousness, freedom, bliss, will, knowledge, action, six, the last is the power of action. With that, he decides to make manifest, all of this whole universe, to manifest every potentiality that exists, a whole spectrum.
Yeah.
Okay, so what happens when we, as human conscious entities, know anything? This pen, or love, or whatever it might be, whether tangible or intangible. What's happening from this non-dual perspective? Is the universe is becoming aware of itself as X, becoming aware of the manifestation of its potential to be X. So when I know this pen, that is to say when I observe it in a very basic sense, or when I know it in some deeper sense, when I perceive its innate penness or whatever, that is nothing other than the universe becoming aware of itself as pen. the universe becoming aware of its potential to be pen manifest. Does that make sense? Non-dual perspective is the context here, right? Since I am the universe, I mean, all of us, again, once again, that whole idea of observer-observe, right? The observer is made of the same stuff, the observer is part of the same field, right? So human beings, in a sense, manifest the conscious aspect, perhaps not exclusively human beings, but human beings manifest the conscious aspect of this universe. We are the means by which, if I can use a silly metaphor, we are the means by which God has downloaded consciousness into the structure of reality. So whenever you know anything, it is the means by which the universe, stroke God, experiences itself as that thing. Because this is a theology where God wants to experience itself as everything. That's why he created a universe out of himself. Because he wants to experience himself as love, as pain, as death, as beauty, as flowers, and as pens. As everything, as every possible thing, exploding nebula, you know, whatever. Okay. I hope this is making some degree of sense. Okay, consciousness is the fundamental property of the universe, then. We manifest that power of knowing. Okay, so now I'm going to try and link the whole thing back to cognitive science.
If you want to erase it, there's a, you have to use that spray. Squirt a little of that spray on.
Okay.
It will bleed everywhere.
Okay. Can I use this thing?
The rag will work better, actually. Yeah.
There are other whiteboards for you.
The circular motion.
There are whiteboards where you don't
left
need
to the right. Wax on, wax off.
This doesn't even qualify as a whiteboard.
It's a junky whiteboard.
Okay. So, okay, what I'm gonna try and clarify these things. I'm going to introduce these two key terms, which Abhinava Gupta uses, prakasha and vimarsha, okay? Which we might translate as, prakasha is literally light. Professor Sanderson likes to translate it as manifestation, because of the whole idea that nothing that is not known can be thought of as manifest. Okay.
Could you say that again? Sorry. Nothing that is not. I think I got lost in the negative. Sorry.
Right. Sorry. See, too much Sanskrit. This is what they do all the time. Multiple negative.
Yeah.
Okay. Manifestation equals knowledge. Knowledge equals manifestation in this idealist system, because if there's anything that is not known by anyone, then it doesn't exist. I mean, we might say to all intents and purposes, but for Abhinava Gupta, it really doesn't exist. Just as a physicist might say that the interior of a black hole does not exist in our universe, because it has no way of affecting our universe whatsoever. Unless you count Hawking radiation, but the interior of the black hole is cut off completely. Nothing, you know, once you're in, you're not going to get out, and vice versa. So anyway.
Sorry, can I just ask, the things go into the black hole like light, so that's affecting your universe?
You mean in the sense that they have been absented from our universe? Yeah, okay. So maybe it's not the perfect analogy, but I mean to say, whatever is inside is utterly unknowable to us. Okay, we can theoretically construct what's inside the black hole, but it's unknowable. Therefore, it does not exist for us. Anyway, it's just a metaphor. The point is that the reason that this term that means light is translated as manifestation by Sanderson is because knowing is being. There's a collapse of ontology and epistemology in this system. If it's not known, it doesn't exist, because knowing is the means by which something could be said to exist. because it only exists if it exists as a known object in somebody's experience. And of course, from a non-dual perspective, there isn't just somebody, there's God, who's everybody. Okay. So anyway, light, we'll just say light for now. And Vimarsha, comes from the Sanskrit root mersh, to touch. So literally, I'll translate it as awareness, and as a technical term, it means self-reflective awareness. And, I mean, you can see the connection with the original root of the word, mersh, to touch something with your mind, with your awareness. But Abhinavagupta uses it to mean self-reflective awareness. Okay, so these are two fundamental concepts for him, because this encompasses the whole of the universe. Prakasha is the shining forth of the Absolute in one form or an infinity of forms. Prakasha then is the manifestation of the universe. It is this, the light metaphor is because this terminology is often used. An object shines almost means it exists in this system. It shines forth. It comes into being. Okay, but if you only had Prakasha, you would have a non-self-aware universe. You'd have a jada universe, inert, not conscious universe. Okay. So in the first chapter of Tantrasara, he says, if you're looking at the thing, it's after the semicolon, the essential nature of all things, the swabhava of all things, is nothing other than the light in all existent things. Prakasha. Because it is impossible for there to be an essential nature of anything other than light. Nothing can have any essential nature other than that of light, other than that of manifestation stroke illumination. That must be the essential nature of all things, as I was just outlining. Okay, that light is not multiple due to the we can say it's not multiple because of the absence of any differentiation in its essential nature, and because it is impossible for any other essential nature to enter into it. So that is to say, it isn't, you couldn't talk meaningfully about any other essential nature of anything other than its shining forth, its manifestation, its existence. Even time and space do not divide it, because both of them have that very light as their essential nature. So here he's asserting that consciousness, prakasha, the shining forth of consciousness into manifestation, is a priori. So therefore, time and space are not a limitation of it, because they are products of it. They're the a posteriori factors. Okay, that is to say, time and space are properties of the universe created by the manifestation of consciousness, which is something physicists would agree with also, of course. That time and space, the question, what was there before the Big Bang, is meaningless, because time is a property of the universe created at the moment of the Big Bang. Okay, it's after the fact. So therefore, he says, ekam prakasham, light is only one, ekam eva prakasham, and it is nothing but consciousness. For consciousness is the illumination of objects. On this there is consensus amongst everyone. He's just quoting an agreed upon idea in Indian philosophy. Consciousness is the illumination of objects, means it's the ubiquitous metaphor of light. If photons of light were not bouncing off this page, none of us could see it. In the same way, consciousness is the illumination of objects, that is to say, the awareness of objects. Of course, it's complicated by the fact that he doesn't really think there's an external universe to consciousness. The whole universe is internal to consciousness. It might be external to Jonathan's consciousness, in a sense, but when Jonathan attains his true nature as all-expansive Paramashiva, or Paramavishnu, whatever, then he'll realize the whole universe is internal to his consciousness and that there is no Jonathan, in fact. Qua Jonathan, yeah. So he says, furthermore, this light is not dependent upon another, for dependence is specifically the quality of being illumined. And the quality of being illumined specifically connotes the requirement of another light, and there is not any other light whatsoever. Hence, this light of consciousness must be the first principle of the universe. It can't be dependent on anything else, because then you would need another light, another consciousness to illumine that one. And there isn't another one, A, and you'd have the problem of infinite regress. So he says, thus light, the light of consciousness, is one and independent. Due to its independence, it is free of limitations of space, time, and form. Therefore, it is all-pervasive, eternal, and has a nature which is formless, even while assuming all forms. That is to say, even as it manifests in all the forms of this universe, it yet retains its formless character. The freedom, the absolute freedom of consciousness is retained. It's not bound by the forms it takes on. It still retains that freedom. Okay, so... I realize when you read a literal translation of Sanskrit that it's hard to wrap your head around, not because the concepts are that difficult, because the way Sanskrit expresses itself is relatively alien to the English-speaking mind, certainly. Okay, so now that was all about Prakasha. So Vimarsha is the power by which the universe is then aware of itself. So you can almost think of a physical metaphor. There's this shining forth, right? And then there's this kind of folding back by which consciousness is aware of itself, both in its pure form and as the existence, the form that it has taken on and manifested as. Okay? So this is going to become clear, I promise, when I explain it in terms of contemporary cognitive science. So, cognitive scientists generally agree about this. What you have in the brain when you see something or experience something is, first you have what's called the first order representation of the object in the brain. So you look at this. Don't pay attention to the form, but just the color, blue. Okay? You look at this blue pen cap. There's a first order representation in the brain, an initial neural representation of blue. The wavelength of the color passing through the photoreceptors, through the optic nerve, registering in the visual cortex as blue. Okay? Now, everybody has this, animals have it, even plants, seaweed, you know, have this. What's next? A higher order representation, okay? Sometimes called the second order representation. That is the awareness of the first order representation, okay? So, here we have blue. By the way, this is terminology that's used in Shaiva philosophy also, talking about blue versus blueness and all this kind of stuff. So, then the second order representation is the awareness of blueness as a property of the pen cap, okay? Now, the first one is part of modern science. This first order representation is not accounted for by Abhinavagupta because he's not aware of the operation of the visual cortex and the optic nerve and all those things. Okay, so here we have the awareness of blueness. This is his prakasha. Okay, but then there's another stage, the third order representation, and that is the awareness of the cognition of blueness. And here we encounter the problem of terminology. So I can just cross this out and just say cognition, the sort of, because here I want to use another term, awareness. Because this is a meta-awareness. Or I could say awareness, meta-awareness. You see, they're just semantics. So the awareness of the cognition, or the meta-awareness of the awareness of blueness. Okay, now you've all had this. This is nothing complicated. Here, you're cognizing that the pen cap is blue. Here, you take an inner step back, which this we don't do very often. unless we're meditators, and we've probably tried to do it a lot. You take an inner step back and you are aware that you are thinking that the pen cap is blue. Very simple here, but it becomes more complicated in interpersonal relations and so on, you know. So here you're aware that you're angry at someone. I mean, here the anger is registering in the limbic system, and in fact this happens before your awareness of it, so you can actually start your punch or your running before you're even feeling afraid or angry or anything, because it registers in the brain first, then the awareness comes. Here you're aware you're angry, and here you're taking the step back and instead of just feeling anger, you're aware, I am angry. And you have that meta-awareness, of course. It's taught in meditative practices that you can then exercise choice, you know, how you're going to act on that or not act on it. So let me give you another example. Like I said, many of us can drive on a kind of autonomic system. We've driven enough. You've all experienced it where you're driving along, you've just passed an intersection, and you realize you have no recollection of ever registering, was that light red or green? And you're hoping it was green because you went right through. I can assure you, if you were in autonomic mode, it was green, because cognitive science shows that the brain is able to register the green, act accordingly without any consciousness of it at all. If it had been red, that would have registered, it would have popped up in consciousness, and the brake would have been hit, you know. I mean, unless you're drunk or just really out of it. In general, it's proven now in many other ways as well that we can have we can cognize something like blue without being aware that we've cognized it. Okay, there's all kinds of wonderful experiments that demonstrate this. Like when there's a chemical smell of bananas in one file and a chemical smell of rancid butter in another file, but they're so weak that you can't consciously smell them. And they give them to people and say, smell this, now smell this. No difference, don't smell anything. Okay, well, pick which one you like more. Well, I didn't smell the difference. Well, just pick one anyway. Vast majority of people pick the bananas instead of the rancid butter, even though they're not aware of any difference. So something's happening in the brain that you're not aware of, okay? So now, these map, again, the second onto prakasha, the third onto vimarsha. So vimarsha is what happens when you become aware of your own process of cognition. So it seems that the Indian tradition, from the Upanishads to Shaivism, usually argues that this third is a property only of human beings. Okay, all living things have this in some way. Some living things have this also. Certainly, you know, all mammals seem to. And only humans have this meta-capacity, this third-order representation. Now, cognitive scientists have raised the question, is the higher-order representation, the consciousness of your cognitions, is it a perfect reflection of those cognitions, or is it an abstraction? When we're aware of blueness, you know, it basically boils down to, are we really experiencing the universe as it is? Or are we just experiencing our experience of the universe? Are we always at least one step of a remove? Well, from the point of view of philosophy, Indian philosophy is informed by meditation, I think you could say that both are possible, and some cognitive scientists argue that both are possible. And that as you continue to refine your mental awareness through a practice like meditation, you come closer and closer to cognitions which accurately do represent what you're cognizant of, rather than as abstractions. That's a whole nother question. And of course, for Abhinavagupta, it's something of a non-question, because he, again, is an idealist who doesn't think that there is a universe other than the one created by consciousness in consciousness. That is to say, all of us, as God, have co-created, or just created, since there's no multiplicity, this whole universe within our own awareness. So therefore, there's nothing external. So Vimarsha, self-reflective awareness, ultimately kind of culminates in what you might describe as a mystical state, which is captured by the phrase Purnoham Vimarsha, which you could variously translate as the self-reflective awareness, I am perfect, or the perfect I consciousness. Alex, do you have a translation of... I've seen it like this, I don't know. So, yeah, Purnoham Iti Vimarsha would definitely imply that awareness, I am perfect. But if it's occurring like this, the perfect awareness of I, that's another possibility.
It has to be a compound.
Yeah, yeah, it's funky. But it's certainly referring to, I think, a kind of mystical state. The I here is not the limited I of Jessica or Jonathan. It's when the limited ego has in fact expanded to infinite proportions. You might call it a case of a delusion of grandeur, but if the ego expands to the size of the entire universe, then in fact it's a true cognition, because you have realized your oneness with the universe, or not to say your oneness, the fact that there is only one. Okay? So, and that one is perfection, is purna, is absolutely full. The word purna means simultaneously complete, full, perfect, and whole. Okay? So the whole process of self-reflective awareness kind of culminates in this kind of ideal state. What time is it?
We've been going for 50 minutes.
So
52 minutes.
Okay. Well, I'll just sort of wrap it up there. We'll bring it into discussion. I realize it's been totally chaotic, more or less. But I wanted to tease out basically these correlations between these ideas of the nature of consciousness and cognitive science, and just kind of give a general overview of the situation. I've also given you, just for your own reference, some definitions of what Tantra is on the top, and then my second one is my definition of Shaiva Tantra, really. Well, it's Tantra generally, but skewed towards Shaiva Tantra, and the characteristics of Shaiva Tantra below, which weren't necessary for this talk, but it just kind of gives you a better sense of what world we're dealing with here. And you have this translation of chapter one that you can bang your head against. And once you translate the Sanskritic English to normal English, it does make sense. Okay, so I guess I'll just grind to a halt there, and we can talk about it.
I can't say anything because I'm lost. I'm trying to figure out this model of how consciousness and ontology are mixing, and it's so close to what I'm doing. And thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
It's really hard for a minute, so please.
I'd like to ask then, in the Bhagavatam, you find the statement several times that God sees everything from everywhere. I'm not quite sure if I can understand how this would fit.
God sees everything from everywhere.
So, I know there's one school of Vaishnavism which says that everything is conscious, the material universe, is conscious. But it doesn't seem like you're saying that. It seems like you're saying that, like you were saying before, that God sort of downloads consciousness into humans. And on the other hand, we do have the universe that's manifesting itself originally as consciousness before time and space.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't quite see. It's a process then.
Yeah,
it's a constant process, so it's wrong to look at it as either or.
Well, it's not. It wouldn't be correct to characterize this view as it seems Aristotle characterized his view, that everything has a spark of life in it. Everything is conscious. It's not what's being said. Everything is a manifestation of consciousness. So the difficulty is, in wrapping your head around it, is like once a student asked me, so is the pen conscious? And people kind of generally have in the back of their heads some idea, is the pen really an entity in and of itself, because it is a manifestation of divine consciousness. Not exactly, because there isn't multiplicity, first of all. Mm-hmm. And second of all, the pen is conscious in the sense that we are knowing the pen. And consciousness is, again, through us becoming aware of itself as pen. So the pen exists in consciousness, so the pen is consciousness, because there is nothing else. There's no proof that anything exists outside of consciousness, and for Abhinava that's enough to say, therefore nothing does. Do you see what I mean?
The difference between pantheism and pantheism, actually, I think that's the sort of Christian way of languaging it, which is that panentheism uses an old Jewish story, the European story of God making a space in himself and permitting the universe to kind of play in that space.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas pantheism is your spark in everything.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So God is in everything is different from saying God manifests as everything, which is more precisely describing this worldview, you know.
Just to add, nothing concrete to that, but I sympathize with the difficulties in trying to convey it. This is exactly what Heidegger says, and he says it because it's exactly what Plato says in certain texts. There's this light ontology, the notion that what exists is simply what is perceived, and that existence is perception is absolutely interwoven to into Western metaphysics all the way through, from 500 BC onwards.
But did they assert? Did they make this assertion? Does anyone in the Western tradition make this assertion that sort of in the chicken and the egg, consciousness came first, and then whatever
it perceives? Isn't it? I mean, I think it's a great curious. It's a curious thing in a way. If you start by analyzing the world not with a prior model of a me and a thing, but just on the basis of the only thing that it's definite is the experience itself, you get what you might call a phenomenological, a conscious-oriented model, and one comes out with that metaphysics.
The
question is what happens when you then want to say, so look, we've figured out that consciousness is the substrate of everything that's going on here. And then if you're a Shaiva, you do two things. First of all, you say, so consciousness is separate of the contents in it. Like, we can get rid of all the contents and we can just have that consciousness. It's a bit like saying you could have matter or energy without it being something in particular, which is an interesting assertion. You know, you use the sort of analogy of matter, but you can't have matter just matter without it happening to be.
Is that right, though?
Something,
is
if you see what I mean.
Can you have consciousness without content?
I think you're saying that you can. And that's part of what's distinctive about this position. And then to go further.
There's a problem there in the sense that if you say that, it has to be kind of like, you seem to be expressing this in terms of chronology. You know, the idea that things first, inhere in Shiva, right?
Uh-huh.
And then he decides. So all this kind of terminology, he decides to then manifest these potentialities, into what we call content. So
metaphorically,
it's kind
of
like this: the chicken and the egg thing is actually there. First, there is pure consciousness. So there, if you're looking for it, you can find it at the beginning. At some point, there's the Ichcha Shakti that comes into play. So he decides, I want the content.
That's right. However, the whole account, that whole kind of mythological account is. They don't say this is exactly what happened. They say this is the best way to understand this, because in fact at all times both are present, both the manifestation and the pure potential. That is to say, it would be wrong to say consciousness is separate from what it perceives, and that's what you have in Sankhya, of course, and that is what you experience in the meditative practice when you advance to the level of Sankhya. But then they say you go further and you realize that consciousness is not separate from what it perceives, but that there are simply two states, the expressed and the potential, the explicit and the implicit, and both are always present. generally speaking, in these deep states of meditation, it is alleged that you can just experience the implicit without the explicit. That is to say, the mental, the mind stuff is not, the chittas are not vrittiing, you know, it's not, they're not doing anything, but you're still there in the state of awareness. But in general, in all experiences, there's both. And that's why you can also do mindfulness practice. You can also step back and be aware of consciousness even when there is activity, either externally or internally. Do you see what I'm saying?
You can do that because there is a content, otherwise you wouldn't be able to do that.
Right, no, in mindfulness practice there is a content,
mm-hmm.
but there's the simultaneous expression and the explicit and the implicit, the consciousness and what is within the consciousness, not outside of it, but it is held within it. So, but you're doing this thing when you're doing mindfulness. You're stepping back and being aware of the whole process of cognition. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So this was always present, but you were not, that is to say, the locus of your awareness. Where is that? Is it here in the object, or is it on the cognition of the object, which is moving to the third order representation?
But I feel like instead of arriving to the point where you are pure consciousness, you're arriving to the point where you are what the Advaitin would call a witness.
Yeah.
Which obviously, being a witness is not pure awareness, because you're a witness of something, of content. So the practice, if that is the practice, if it culminates in that experience of being a witness, I do wonder what non-duality that is.
No, I wouldn't say it culminates in the experience of being the witness. I think that's a stage on the in the process, because it culminates in the experience of being the witness and the witnessed,
mm-hmm.
in a sense. But it's weird. It's just like the Buddhists sometimes say, you have to build a healthy ego before you can annihilate the ego. In practice, you need to have a strong mind to withstand meditation, and then you obliterate that mind. In the same way, you first distinguish consciousness from what it is conscious of, and then you take this higher step in Shaivism of realizing that there is no, that this whole thing isn't real. It's hard for me to talk about it because I haven't gotten to that stage. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I can't even.
But there is something further than this.
Yes, yes, that they talk about. I can't fully grasp it. But again, it's sort of typified in this fourfold thing that Abhinavagupta is really into, which is the creation of a cognition, its maintenance, its dissolution, and then the fourth transcendental nameless state beyond that process, which is also these three are also identified as the knower, the process of knowing the object known. But it's not that you become rooted in the knower, the suction, and then you're done. That is a stage. But then further beyond that, these three utterly dissolve into this kind of nameless transcendental state where there is not even a knower.
Mm.
So that's what it's hard for me to speak about that.
And the last thing. Because I wanted to get a clarification on, you started by differentiating Samkhya and this Shaiva Tantra Siddhanta, where you say the Shaiva tradition goes a step further, and then you compared the Anakya idea to the Samadhi, where you see it goes a step further because then it removes, you know, all dualities and the knower included, which is linked to, you know, with what you just spoke about. But I was wondering here, if you don't think it's important to make a differentiation between not comparing samadhi and anakya, but nirvikalpa samadhi, which to me is the exact same experience, where duality is in all senses of the term.
Yeah.
Right?
That's fine,
the
yeah.
The agent, the
right.
subject, whatever,
yeah.
any kind of duality, subject, object, means of knowledge, those three are also gone.
That's right.
Entering maybe that fourth, which you might actually equate with anakya. So then if those two are the same, then how would you then...
Yeah, anakya couldn't be
experience,
couldn't be the same as samadhi. Maybe you could say it was similar to what Patanjali calls asampragnata
yes.
samadhi,
which are
the same as nirvikalpa samadhi. Yeah, I mean, I think they are the same. I don't think Abhinavagupta would say they are the same, because he has another interpretation, which is, I mean, for him. manifestation, you know, is something real, and multiplicity is something real, but it's all different phases and forms of one consciousness manifesting itself as a real multiplicity of objects, you know, and that, you know, so that dissolves and then is recreated both, you know, in the whole cycle of the universe, and in the ongoing process of manifestation and dissolution every moment, you know. So it's not that you're kind of realizing that, see, you know that I'm it's hard for me to compare this with Vedanta, but there is a difference, and I don't know if I'm pointing towards it. Maybe there isn't a difference in actual phenomenology. And I think this is where it gets confusing, because I do think a lot of this came out of this, a lot of this philosophy came out of a phenomenological account of experience based in meditation. But a lot of it is also theology and abstract philosophy that that isn't as compelling to us in the modern period, perhaps, because it doesn't have as much psychological resonance, because it is deriving elements from, you know, the culture of the time and dialectic with other groups, especially Buddhism, for example. And these guys might be sitting there experiencing the exact same thing, but they've got to fight the Buddhists because they're the enemy. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So to what extent... I mean, the implications are obviously thought to be different from Vedanta, in the sense that you can utilize anything in the world as a means to experience divine consciousness, because it all is divine consciousness. So therefore, it's a non-renunciatory tradition. I mean, this is one of the implications of this view. You don't need to renounce, because you can a means to experience consciousness can be found anywhere in anything, potentially, although it might be much harder in certain circumstances. And this is why we have this very weird text, the Vijnana Bhairava, where you do all these bizarre practices, sneezing, riding in an ox cart, having sex, whatever, all these kind of daily life things are pointed to and said, in these moments you can experience your true nature, where suddenly you expand beyond your limited sense of identity into a limitless and absolutely free autonomous consciousness. So that doesn't appear in Vedanta, I think, so much.
Mm-hmm. Samkhya yoga. Anyway. Yes.
Anyway. Maybe we should see if there's any other questions.
I have a science and religion question.
Yeah.
Which we started these seminars in order to enter dialogue with Western cognitive science, and you brought up many interesting points. I mean, what I find particularly interesting here is how you mapped on Prakasha and Vimarsha onto this tripartite analysis that Western cognitive science, common in textbook Western cognitive science.
Mm-hmm.
But you also brought in this fourth state, Purnoham Vimarsha.
Mm-hmm.
I think all the Indian traditions would agree with this initial tripartite analysis, and then posit something beyond that. There's some state of consciousness which transcends ordinary states of consciousness that ordinary people have access to. And if one is saying that this final or fourth or whatever state of consciousness is consciousness as it is, it's the prayojana, the goal of your practice. My question is, in what sense is there any way that Western cognitive science could be used as a vehicle towards these other states of consciousness? And at the same time, is there any way in which Western cognitive science could be used in the service, so to speak, of practitioners of these traditions?
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, the first thing Yeah, all people do experience these three, although some people do the third more than others.
Mm.
And I think it's interesting and key that, in a sense, in Indian traditions, this third level is kind of thought of as a springboard to the fourth. Just like in Patanjali, you want to go beyond the gunas, but it's easier to go beyond the gunas if you've cultivated sattva, as opposed to rajas or tamas, you know?
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, it's easier to kind of go beyond ordinary states of consciousness if you've cultivated a lot of meta-awareness in this third-order representation.
Mm.
So in that sense, you know, just... obviously, cognitive scientists are spending a lot of time thinking about their own cognitions. And what I find interesting is two of the books I was looking at, Consciousness and Introduction by Susan Blackmore, who's recommended to us by the other guy who's here.
Dr. Afisi.
Yeah. And then this other book, Consciousness by Rita Carter, both have a chapter or even two chapters on meditation and Eastern philosophy in light of consciousness studies. And Rita Carter, which is interesting, she's a scientist, she writes very objectively through her whole book, and then at the very end, she basically reveals how she got into this whole thing because she had these spontaneous mystical experiences. Mystical in the kind of academic sense of the word. For example, she had this horrible night. She was driving, car broke down, middle of the night, raining, cold. The guy comes and fixes the car on the side of the road but says it's bound to break down again at any moment. And she's like, "Do you know anywhere I can stay? Here in the English countryside, 3 a.m. And he's like, "No." And he's like, "Oh, well, actually, my aunt has a spare room. I'll take pity on you." So he brings her there, and his aunt turns out to be one of these motherly type people who fusses over her and gets her all warm and dry and puts her in a nice room with a roaring fire and a hot soup and all this stuff. Anyway, so I'm setting up the context because she thought it was important. So she gets into the bed and is like, it's just been such a horrible time, and now it's like warm and safe and dry and about to go to sleep. And she looks at the fire and realizes I should turn the fire off. It's a gas, one of those gas flame fake log things. And suddenly something extraordinary happens where she felt that she was seeing the fire from within, that she was the fire as well as herself. And then she realized that that was happening because, in fact, she was the bed and the walls and the curtains. She was seeing it all from the perspective of being it. She says it's hard to describe because there is no words. There's no words in this state, but she really didn't have any identification with that body. And then she realized her identification had spread out beyond the room. That she had an awareness of what was beyond the walls of the room, even though she couldn't see them with her physical eyes. It was accompanied, as these experiences often are, by a deep, pervasive sense that everything was right.
Mm.
It was just as it should be, was beautiful, was perfect. And that furthermore, that this was the true nature of reality. And she said, it wasn't a thought, it was a knowing, a wordless knowing. And anyway, she goes on to become a cognitive scientist, and she says, now, as a scientist looking back on this experience, I really cannot say if it was truth or not, if it was just a state that the human brain has access to, which tells us no more about reality than our ordinary states of consciousness. She said, having had the experience, she wouldn't be prepared to say it tells us less about reality, but some people do argue that because it's a rare experience, a rare brain state to be in, that it must be less meaningful for the nature of reality than our ordinary states of consciousness. People who have the experience are unlikely, I think, to say that. But she was saying, she was basically framing this question and then leaving it open and saying, we don't have an understanding yet of what this means. Clearly something's happening in the brain, but it is, of course, the most naive of all objections to religious phenomena for somebody to say, oh, that's just neurons firing in your brain, because as she points out really cleverly, I thought, our brains are equipped to see color whereas animals' brains are not, on the most part, equipped to see color. But the fact that we're neurally wired to see color doesn't mean that color doesn't exist. Mm. Just as the fact that we may be neurally wired to experience God is hardly a disproof of God. Do you know what I mean? Mm.
Could be the other way around.
Rita Carter is just called Consciousness. It's a great, it's written for undergraduates kind of thing. Great summary of, and has little mini essays from all these thinkers. Very readable. And then also Blackmore gets into these meditative experiences and so on and so forth. And I think what's happening is Cognoscend is becoming more aware of what this data, the fact that this data is meaningful, because it's appearing in these books, and it wasn't 5 years ago, to mm-hmm. my knowledge.
Yeah.
But they don't quite know what to do with it yet, you know? So.
The other thing I wanted to raise is that your distinctions, your mapping that you've mapped out here, is a feature of the kind of crossover between Buddhism and psychology that's various forms of that have been kicking around. And the third state, as you call it there, was, I raised a question with the psychiatrist when he was here about witness consciousness.
Mm.
And being in that third state can be taught as a technique, effectively. I mean, some people have more
yeah.
of a kind of gift for it than others, but it's kind of understood as, in that particular tradition, as it is emerging, as a way of deconstructing your habitual patterns.
Yeah, absolutely.
In much the way that it is in its original tradition, I imagine.
Yeah, I think so. What's interesting is that I think everybody does it, but they just do it very, very momentarily. So one of the techniques I was taught by a really clever guy, he was saying that all of us, just we have streams of thought all day long. We have a thought stream where one thought triggers another, free association. And then we have moments where we kind of come back to ourselves, whether we're walking down the street or wherever we are. If we're lost in thought, we suddenly come back to ourselves, and there's a moment of heightened awareness of our immediate surroundings. And a greater vividness, and it's as if we were somewhere else and we came back into the present moment. And then most of us then review what we were just thinking, and usually sort of pass judgment on whether it was a good train of thought or a bad train of thought. But it's interesting that we take that moment to review, and I mean, I would like to take it as evidence that, again, there's a whole nother principle here, other than just the mind stuff doing its cognition, the chittas doing their vritti, doing their motions, their fluctuations, because we do need to actually stop and, with our meta-consciousness, review what we've just thought about. Sometimes we review it to see where it started, and other times we review it to see whether it was valuable or reprehensible or whatever. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so the point he was saying is, in that moment, you actually can choose, that almost everyone has these moments, and you can choose, wait a sec, just to stay in that moment, instead of review your thoughts and thereby start a new stream of thought and get lost again. This window of opportunity, which for most of us is about a second, you can just sit there for a few seconds, and eventually for longer. So it seems that everybody has this, you know, to some extent.
But
it just
it
has to be cultivated.
Also, I mean, it can depend which way you choose to take it. I mean, in a way, you're choosing there to take it in the meditative tradition. But I can see in that your ox cart metaphor, your kind of your Vedanta, you know, non-renunciate tradition, which says that you can do this all the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. Yeah. And I definitely think I notice that people live very different sorts of lives when they engage in this self-reflective awareness
mm.
more frequently, and they also have more freedom of choice, because, I mean, Rita Carter starts her consciousness book by talking about the illusion of control over consciousness, and that our mind is just jumping all over the place all the time, and we think we're directing it, and most of the time, you know, there's not much free will involved, because we are constantly reactive, you know, and the meditative tradition talks about also samskaras, which are big for Abhinavagupta, not just Patanjali. and how, because of our past experiences, we're constantly reacting to present phenomena as attraction or aversion, just constant, like, and that we think we're choosing, but in fact we're averse to this and attracted to that because of this whole network of past experiences and so on. Mm. So when you engage in this meta-awareness, you actually have something closer to, at least, a real power of free choice. And that's interesting, because Abhinavagupta again says that the most inherent quality of God after consciousness, the most inherent quality of consciousness, is its autonomy. So when you enter into this state of meta-awareness, you experience greater autonomy, which is sort of evidence, as it were, for him, that you're closer to your true divine nature.
And you see, and you're closer to your first stage, as you said, I think. You see blue, perhaps, as just blue. The mountain just as the mountain.
Instead of an abstraction. Well, there's this really nice quote in the Carter book, very interesting, where, what does she say? One way of looking at the accretion of layered awareness, here she's using awareness to mean cognitions, is that it builds an ever